Yesterday we were concerned with the great switch in basic outlook, cosmological outlook, scientific outlook, and in epistemological outlook as well. And there we were concerned with the change from a dualist to a unitary understanding, and from a closed mechanist understanding of the universe to an open dynamic understanding of all things. This is not working? I'm sorry. Right. Is that better? Right. Now today we're concerned with another aspect of that fundamental change, which is a change from the priority of reason over belief to the priority of belief over reason. That is, in Michael Polanyi's terms, to a restoration of the proper balance of our cognitive powers. The Royal Society of London was inaugurated in 1622 with the motto Nullius in Verba, which may be translated on nobody say so. Now, here we have two things. First, scientific knowledge is not gained by analyzing other people's opinions. For example, by scholastic thought, and perhaps one should say that today, almost 90% of books written in theology are written in that way. Scientific knowledge is not gained by analyzing other people's opinions, but from reality itself, the one source of knowledge. And second, science must rely on strictly empirical theoretical methods, in repudiation of all external authorities. To understand the mysteries of nature, we must learn to put our questions directly to nature without deferring to any arbitrary pronouncements and in distrust of all preconceptions and untested hypotheses. Now, what lies behind this motto, the Royal Society, was the work and thought of Francis Bacon. And here we have a very interesting history. When Lorenzo Valla, at the beginning of the Renaissance, was concerned with how we really ask questions, he found that the kind of questions asked in medieval philosophy and theology, the quaestiones, were not genuine questions. They were problematic questions, questions designed simply to straighten out an area of knowledge from A to B, so that B or C followed directly from A. But they were not open interrogative questions. And Valla found he had to go back to the Stoic lawyers, such as Cicero, whom he found interrogating evidence, documents, and events without any preconceptions, and at first without even a clue to where the answer lay. Open interrogation of events, documents, and evidence until the truth began to disclose itself, and then, in the light of a clue, further interrogations were directed until finally the truth came to view. Now, it was when Valla applied that open interrogative way of questioning to history and to historical documents that he found that the donation of Constantine was a fabrication. So the false decretals came to light under this kind of radical questioning. And then we find John Calvin, trained not only in the thought of Valla and probably also Rodolf Agricola in the College of Montague, but trained also at Bourges in Renaissance law by Alciati, and coming to grips with the new interrogative questions of Valla, we find Calvin applying the same method of interrogation to the interpretation of Holy Scripture. Now, Bacon had said that we must interrogate nature in such a way that we allow nature to disclose itself to us. And in allowing nature to disclose itself to us, we have to call in question what he called the idols of the mind. These are all the hidden presuppositions or untested assumptions that we operate with. But we do this in a humble way, and here he applied Calvin's particular method of interrogating the books of God to the books of nature. We approach nature in the form of a servant, putting our question and submitting ourselves to nature, for no one can enter the kingdom of nature, he said, nisi sub persona infantis, except as a little child or an infant. And so here we see a remarkable parallel developing in the Reformation and Renaissance between interpreting the books of nature on the one hand and interpreting the books of God on the other hand. And in Bacon, the work of Varla and the lawyers and the work of Calvin and the Ochino, for example, Bacon married the daughter of Ochino, the other Calvinists are welded together in his concept of scientific interrogation and understanding. Now, what they were concerned with here was to allow nature, or allow the Bible, God's writing in the Bible or God's writing in nature, to interpret itself. They were concerned to lay bare the ongoing self-interpretation of the intelligible revelation of God or the intelligible books of nature, so they were concerned with basically an intrinsic hermeneutic. Now, this had long ago actually been developed. I'm not sure that Calvin is altogether familiar with this, and certainly not Bacon, by St. Anselm, who talked about the intima locutio, the speech which is involved in nature, the intima locutio rerum, and our task, he says, is to interpret, understand it, and he, whether rightly or wrongly, etymologically understood intelligere as intus legere, reading within, penetrating beneath the surface and getting at the speech embedded in nature, because that is the speech embedded in nature which comes ultimately from God's creative word. Well, there you have, I think, a very interesting connection between scientific operations and theological operations. Now, in the following year, the Royal Society was officially inaugurated, officially given its charter, 1623, in which it was enacted, still under the teaching of Bacon, that all investigations are to be conducted in such a way that they may promote useful arts, the glory of the Creator, and the advantage of the human race. Now, while all presuppositions and conceptions have to be called in question by this open interrogative method, and experiments are a physical questioning of nature. That's what experiments are. You put your question to nature so as to allow nature to disclose or reveal itself to you. And while all our preconceptions and presuppositions are thus called in question, there are nevertheless certain basic assumptions which have a regulative control over our knowledge and over all scientific inquiry and theorizing. For example, and these are the primary ones, belief in God, the Creator, and belief in the orderliness of the creation. Now, it's interesting that these are written, and to this day they stand, in the Charter of the Royal Society in London. Now, in that light, let us take Isaac Newton, who was one of the main people concerned with the foundation of the Royal Society. How did he coordinate belief in God, the creative and sustaining ground of all rational order, and his empirical, theoretical explanation of the universal and uniform constitution of things by reasoning from mechanical principles alone? Now, in Bacon we find a profound and a damaging ambiguity. There are two ways in which Bacon related God to the universe. First, there is a relation between the universe and God, he held, is not of the same kind as the relations that obtain within the universe. Now, the relations obtained within the universe, which he sought to bring to systematic formulation and what he called the system of the world, were mechanical causal relations. But he refused to extrapolate these mechanical causal relations from the universe to account for the relation of the universe to God. Here we have to reckon with quite a different kind of relation. He used different expressions for this. He was concerned with the ultimate agency and will and counsel of God. And he spoke of God's free creating of the universe. Now, the point that Bacon is concerned with here really is this, that this universe which he was expressing in this systematic form was not ultimately a self-explaining and self-supporting system. To use later language, the universe, in order to be the intelligible system that Newton found it to be, had to be incomplete. If it was consistent, it had to depend on the creative ground beyond it in God. So that in this way, we find that Newton's whole understanding of the universe anticipates, in a profound way, the Gödelian theorems, which date in our day from about 1930 or 31. But secondly, Newton had another way of thinking of God in relation to in the universe. He found, according to his own figuring, that there were evidently, or apparently, certain so-called irregularities in the planetary and solar system. And in order to keep the universe consistent, in order to give a systematic expression of it, to give ground for his belief in the real orderliness of everything, he thought of God as interacting within the universe in such a way as to make good those gaps, those irregularities. And so here we have the notion of God of the gaps. Now, these are not to be differentiated. The first relation has nothing to do with God of the gaps, and many people think that, but it's the second concept, relation of God to the world, it has to do with relation of God of the gaps. Now, this second way of relating the universe to God was, of course, destroyed by Laplace. Because Laplace, working on with Newton's laws of motion, was able to show that, to the deeper understanding, there are no irregularities of this kind that Newton suspected in the planetary and solar systems, and therefore he did not need that hypothesis God to give a scientific account of the system of the world as a mechanistic system. And so that aspect, the second aspect, second way Newton related God to the world, fell away. But what of the first one? Now, there's no doubt that that was not destroyed at all by Laplace, or indeed any of the later Newtonians. And that remains to this day, and indeed our day, has become immensely reinforced. And that was really what we were concerned with yesterday. The shift from a Newtonian, let's say post-Newton, a Newtonian closed mechanistic universe, to an open and dynamic universe. But in order to do that, we found that Newton's own dualist way of thinking had to be destroyed, and it had to be replaced by a non-dualist, or a basically unitary understanding of form and being, the empirical and the theoretical, and so on. But now, the basic problem that Newton left us was this. Newton's dualist way of relating God to the universe enshrined a deeply embedded deism. Let's say the deism and the dualism were both hinged upon this inertial relation between God and the universe. God acts upon the universe in a form of inactivity. And this had the effect, as we saw yesterday, of giving rise to a mechanistic system, but also giving rise to a deism in which people operating within the paradigms of that deism and mechanistic outlook could no longer believe in any kind of incarnation or resurrection or any kind of miracle, because these things could only be understood as disrupting the structure of the universe and were therefore irrational. And as we saw, Newton himself wouldn't have agreed with rejecting a resurrection or a miracle. Nevertheless, he found that on his own principles he could not believe in the incarnation. Well then, what I'm concerned with this is that the combination of dualism and deism had the effect of driving a wedge between belief in God the Creator and the rational order of the universe. And in so doing, it effected a serious damage in the relation between faith and reason, and thereby ultimately undermined belief in an objective, rational order independent of man. Now that's a very interesting fact. If you give up belief in God as the creator and the ultimate controller of the universe, and you try to understand the universe in terms of its own intrinsic order as though it were self-regulating and self-supporting, ultimately you lose belief in the objectivity of the rational order in the creation. Now that is, you can show that again and again in history. God is replaced first by the fact of the rational order and harmony of the universe, but when that lost its dimension of objectivity, then the notion of God himself fell away, and religion tended to be relegated to man's private inward life. Now, that's what happened with John Locke. And we find that Locke, thinking within the whole structure of Newtonian thought, and developing a pretty radical empiricism, Locke's thought led eventually to the positivist and conventionalist notions of science, which in later times completely rejected the idea that there is any objective rational order in nature. Now Locke operated with a radical dualism, not only of a Newtonian kind, but he went back also to Galileo's phenomenalism and dualism, as we can see in his play in the distinction between primary and secondary qualities, and his radical distinction between material and mental substance. Here we have a reversion to the Aristotelian principle that there is nothing in the mind except what is first in the senses. Everyone begins with a mind devoid of any kind of intuitive ideas, and indeed he never gains any ideas through direct intuitive apprehension or direct intelligible operations. He gains knowledge only through sense impressions, and these sense impressions are received by the mind or the soul under the impact of material substances. So there's a strange way. Knowledge can only be gained as material substances causally produced impressions on our senses. And that, of course, was quite fatal. Here we have then a sharp distinction between faith or reason and belief and rational knowledge, in which Locke held that belief is ultimately no more than an ungrounded persuasion or a private opinion of the mind which falls short of knowledge, for it is not based on the sciences of the science of the senses and is only extraneously related to what is believed. Rational knowledge, real knowledge of any kind, comes from experience, that sense experience, and is established through demonstration operating with quite certain visible connections which are visible to our senses. And this had then the effect of reducing faith to a merely subjective state of affairs and denigrating it as a cognitive act or source of knowledge beyond the range of observation. Now Locke's denigration of faith is also bound up with his extension of Newtonian deism and a rejection of any dynamic relation between God and the world. Now here the law of nature, which you have in a more objective form, in Newton, the law of nature now becomes the law of the reason. And so we have developing a rationalist understanding of science. The law of the reason is identified with the mechanistic conception of nature and its rational laws, but the reason itself is the autonomous reason of the human mind. So that Locke's empiricist rationalism led to a thoroughly anthropocentric positivism in which priority is given to law of the autonomous reason, detached from and without reference back to an objective rational order independent of man. So here you have a concept of natural law, which is grounded on the autonomous reason, and the autonomous reason operates in a relation to sense experience where material substances cause impressions upon my mind, and I elaborate that to my autonomous activity, and I produce knowledge. All right, said David Hume, if you rely upon sense experience like that, tell me, what sensation do you have of causation? There is then no sense experience of the impact of material substances upon my mind. And there is no sense experience of causality between A and B, between one billiard ball and hitting another billiard ball. So if you really think in this empiricist way and will only ground knowledge on sense experience, then there is no possibility for establishing any kind of objective necessity in nature or any kind of objective causality. Now, of course, that was quite devastating. And it looked as though the whole ground of modern science were undermined. Now, this led to the problems of Kant and Mach, about which I wrote yesterday. And I won't go into them. But science seemed to be faced here with the failure of observationalism. The whole way of thinking in terms of observations and dealing with sense data and observational data, and then trying to deduce ideas from these or deduce hypotheses from these, working them up through logical, inferential ways into theories, all that began to collapse. And so we find modern science in a much deeper predicament. As we saw yesterday, this led to the idea that we have in Mach and Company that scientific concepts are not really controlled by nature and they have no objective ontological ground. They are simply convenient arrangements of our observational data. They are, in fact, thought symbols, mental artifices for which we can complain, we can claim no relation to objective reality. As I pointed out of this comes logical positivism and the positive notions of law, which are so widespread in your country and mine. Well, the first one was widespread, now, thank you, it's rather diminished. Now, that was the problematic situation within which James Clerk Maxwell was at work in the third quarter of the 19th century. But now at work with a mind very deeply rooted in God. In a lecture to the British Association in 1873, he told his fellow scientists that he had a profound belief in the divine power and wisdom by which the world were created, and he revealed there the ultimate regulative beliefs which lay behind his whole scientific thought. Here we find a combination of profound faith in God with profound respect for the nature of creation, which made Clerk Maxwell unusually sensitive to fundamental beliefs and to epistemological grounds on which natural science must rest if it is to penetrate in any small measure into the mysteries of nature. So here we have a deep intuitive communication with God, the infinite author of all finite being, and an intuitive communication with the whole cosmos from which man is physically and intelligibly inseparable, and that double intuitive relation constituted the unshakable foundation of his confidence and gave him an awesome and humbling insight into the nature of created reality. The universe, as Maxwell understood it, was characterized by flexible structural relatedness, which he called the divine process of nature, in which man himself shares as a creature of God, in tune with which he is summoned to pursue his scientific inquiries. And here we see Bacon's concept that the scientist, in pursuing his scientific inquiries, is acting in obedience to God, because God has planted man in nature, in order that it may be his task as a kind of priest of creation to allow nature to come to word. So that when nature comes to word and expresses itself in this way, all creation joins in the harmonious praise to God, the Creator. Now, this is not to imply that James Clerk Maxwell allowed his fundamental convictions he gained prior to scientific reasoning to control that reasoning in any way. For he constantly made it a point of putting his controlling beliefs, scientific or theological, to the test in the course of his scientific inquiries by asking whether these scientific inquiries, as they were molded by this intuitive knowledge, as I've called it, yielded tenable theories. His word, tenable theories, an explanation. And by tenable, he meant whether these theories measured up in an acceptable way to the actual continuities and dynamic connections embedded in nature. Now here we have, arising actually out of Clerk Maxwell's boyhood life and experiences in a state in Dumfriesshire, which is one I saw really for the first time when we were celebrating, or rather commemorating, his death in 1879, an estate of extraordinary beauty in which the young boy roamed around and made himself completely familiar with everything and absorbed the nature around him and looked at it in the light of what he learned from God, from his mother and his father, in the face of Jesus Christ. Now here I'd like to point out to several of his leading ideas and to note the importance of them. First, we have a concept of the relations between things. The concept that relations between things, whether they are objects or events, belong to what things really are. For in nature, all things are inseparably and ontologically connected together in the field in which they are found. That is to say, relation now becomes the most important thing to know, and it's in understanding relation that you really penetrate into the interior structure of things and are able to grasp them in their intelligibility. Now it's interesting to note that this idea was not derived by James Clerk Maxwell from the physics department in the University of Edinburgh, where he went up to study as a boy of 14, just after 14. His first paper read to the Royal Society is one he'd written at 14, the next one written at 16, and then he went to Cambridge, and already known as a youngster who was reading papers to the Royal Society in Edinburgh. Well, he learned these ideas, and not from Professor Forbes in the Department of Physics in Edinburgh, but from the Department of Metaphysics and from the lectures of Sir William Hamilton. Now, Hamilton was there working with certain fundamental ideas which have a theological root. Now, let me indicate that, because it's a concept which I myself call the ontorelational concept, the ontorelational idea. It's most clearly seen in the concept of the person, as it developed in the Christian theology from the doctrine of Trinity and Christology. It takes at least two, and certainly three persons to have one. And you aren't a person as an individual locked up in yourself. What you are as a person depends upon your relation with other persons. So that the relation between persons is part of what a person is. The relation of one person to another is part of the very being of the person. So it's not just a relation between two beings, the relation itself is an ontological relation. So persons ontologically depend upon themselves in order to be persons and to have interrelation with one another. So here is a concept of an ontological relation, relations embedded in being, which are essential for what beings are. Now the next concept that we must put alongside of that is that nature abhors partition. I don't think that Clerk Maxwell ever read Athanasius, we know he did in Cambridge, come back from the Cavendish Laboratories and spent some of his time studying the Bible and reading the Fathers, but I'm not aware of his having mentioned reading Athanasius, but Athanasius tells us that we cannot engage in what he called partitive thinking. Partitive thinking in theology is impossible. That's what we would call analytical, dissecting thinking. The kind of partitive thinking you have in Newtonian atomism on the particular view of nature. But certainly Clerk Maxwell is in tune with that when he says, nature as he knows it abhors a partition. And so he was suspicious of the whole classical approach of dividing the universe up, as we saw yesterday, into discrete particles, and then after analytical methods of investigation, trying to relate them to one another. Newton's concept, for example, of action at a distance was now highly suspect. At the best, all this could lead only to partial explanations, he said, and partial explanations were damaging and distorting. Then the third principle I want to note is what he called embodied mathematics. Now this was a concern for a more empirically relevant and appropriate mathematics which does not detach processes of thought from contact with physical reality through the substitution of symbolic for real connections, but allows the mind to lay hold upon physical realities and physical relations and to bring to expression their intrinsic relations and cohesions. Now the result was that he was rather dissatisfied with traditional linear mathematics, because mathematics of course breaks everything up into timeless units and then works these together in equations and manipulates them in that kind of a way. And Maxwell, who was certainly one of the greatest mathematicians of his time, was very suspicious of merely abstract mathematics, because ultimately it was only a tautological game. The only kind of mathematics that is a real concern is what he called embodied mathematics. And right away, even at the age of 16, we find him arguing with this contemporaries in Cambridge. Well, the long and short of these three principles that I'm mentioning was a profound dissatisfaction with the mechanical interpretation and explanation of radiation, which he himself had attempted in his book on Faraday's Lines of Force, developing thoughts, inheriting thoughts from Faraday and a certain concept of the field theory from Faraday. Clerk Maxwell attempted to interpret that, bringing electromagnetism and light together, interpret that in terms of Newtonian mechanics, and as he himself judged it, that was ultimately untenable. He became dissatisfied with his own work. And you know, to this day, I think that most physicists seem to think that that was Maxwell's contribution. For example, when we were celebrating in Edinburgh, I keep on saying celebrating, commemorating Clerk Maxwell's death and celebrating his achievements, I found that we didn't have the copy of his collected works, which is printed over here, reprinted over here by the Dover publication, and maybe it is now to print again. But we had only the ancient editions, they come from the end of the 19th century, edited by W.D. Niven a few years after Maxwell's death. We had only two copies in Edinburgh University Library. One was held in the vaults and not allowed to be used, and the other one hadn't been used for 20 years. Now, several years earlier, I had an argument with the head of our physics department, Professor Cochrane, who was himself a Cambridge man, about Maxwell, and he claimed that you could only interpret Maxwell in terms of a mechanical interpretation of the magnetic field, and I said, no, that's the very thing he departed from. No, when I found that Maxwell's collected works hadn't been read, I realized that even Cochrane himself, great scientist though he is, hadn't paid sufficient attention to this. Now, when Maxwell was dissatisfied with this, he found he had to write a different thing altogether. And so he produced a document called A Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Field, in which he transferred the partial differential equations from his earlier works to this one, but made no use of Newtonian mechanics. Now, that is the document which had such a profound influence on Einstein, and upon which ultimately Einstein's whole way of thinking took root and from which it developed. Now, I grant you that Maxwell still has problems. He produces after this a textbook for students, just like the kind of textbooks that you have to this day for the younger people, and which he lapses back into a Newtonian geometrical attempt at setting forth an understanding of electromagnetic field. Now, what I'm after, however, is this. Maxwell found he had to move from a mechanical interpretation, an explanation of radiation, to a dynamical and relational understanding because, ultimately, of the regulative role played by his profound faith in God. A God, as he is revealed as Father through Jesus Christ, his incarnate Son, that is the God that set in motion and controlled from behind Maxwell's scientific understanding and development. Natural science he held as a way of looking at the universe and its marvelous patterns of order, the universe which God has made and endowed with its harmony and rational beauty. Our scientific explanations, all our scientific explanations, are bound to be impartial and complete, and real explanations must lie beyond what the scientist can see and figure out with his mathematics. Now contrast for a moment James Clerk Maxwell and Newton. Newton undoubtedly was a devout man and had profound faith in God, but Newton's whole outlook, as we've seen, was deist. But we don't find any deism in Clerk Maxwell's outlook. God, the Creator, is not inertially related to the ongoing universe. He finds no support, therefore, for the notion of the universe as a closed and necessary mechanistic system from any kind of doctrine of God. God is rather the active and loving Father of Jesus Christ, his incarnate Son. Maxwell stressed that. And it is in and through Jesus Christ that we have disclosed to us something of the incomparable nature of his divine power and wisdom as he is creatively and invisibly at work in all the processes of nature. Later on this year, in the summer, a book of mine called Divine and Contingent Order is being published by Oxford University Press, and I end that book with an unpublished prayer from James Clerk Maxwell, which shows the centrality of his faith in God, the Creator, and the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, God's incarnate Son. And I'm rather interested to see what the scientists are going to make of this prayer of Clerk Maxwell, because quite clearly it expresses the profound faith that he had behind his science. But now note, Clerk Maxwell did not obtrude theological ideas as such anywhere into his scientific theories, when he discusses and develops a scientific theory or explanation, he does not bring in his theological concepts. No. But his ultimate beliefs in God and in the incarnation influence his intuitive choice and formation of scientific ideas. So here we see in Maxwell at work belief in God exercising a profoundly regulative role behind all his thinking and all his scientific activity. An intuitive insight of a deeply religious kind. Now when we turn from Maxwell to Einstein, then that is precisely what we see in Einstein. A different mode. Einstein's not a Christian. He's not really concerned in this way with Jesus Christ. But nevertheless, he has a deeply, as he himself claimed, religious outlook upon the universe. Now, more than any other, Einstein discerned the new field theoretical understanding of natural law and the new methods it initiated in seeking to grasp the kind of form that actually inheres in the nature of what we seek to apprehend. And we find, as I spoke about yesterday, him rejecting all forms of dualism and the artificial ways of bringing together the experimental and the theoretical. And I think particularly of a notable lecture he gave to the Prussian Academy on geometry and experience, in which he discussed the relation between the logical formal and the objective or intuitive content of mathematics, and showed that mathematics in science were not concerned with mathematics that is uprooted from the objective or intuitive content. And contrast to Newton, this is what he did. He found that what Newton did in discovering the differential structure of the universe and in elaborating differential law, this whole universe of bodies and motion, he took all that he seemed to grasp and he interpreted it within the framework of the idealizing geometry of Euclid. Let's say he took his observations and his empirical, theoretical knowledge of science, and he crushed it within the mold of an antecedent conceptual system called Euclidean geometry. Now, what Einstein said was that is precisely the problem with Newton. What we must do is to take geometry out of that independent status and put it in the heart of physics, where it becomes the epistemological structure in physics, but where geometry is now integrated with the physical structure of nature, and it becomes, he called, a natural science. And so we're concerned with four-dimensional geometry. Now here we have a way then of relating mathematics and experience, or geometry and experience, in such a way that they inhere in one another. Now this is precisely what Maxwell had called for when he talked about embodied mathematics, at which Maxwell was unable to articulate and bring to expression in the way that Einstein did. Now the all-important point that Einstein stresses here is the need to work with ontologically grounded objectivities and intelligibilities, which can never be completely reduced to conceptual explanations or to mathematical formalizations. If you try to formulate everything through mathematical means, through mathematical generalizations and formalizations, you tend to lose the very important elements that the scientist was concerned with. In one of his books next door here, Richard Feynman has pointed out that the physicist is not, as most physicists seem to think, concerned with general laws and so on. What he is concerned with ultimately is the application of that to the particular case, where what he has figured out mathematically, experimentally, has to be used in order to understand actual concrete experience and concrete nature. Now that's what Einstein was concerned with. But in this radical change, we discover that there are regulative beliefs at the back of Einstein's mind. And in fact, we find a priority of fundamental belief. And there are two basic interconnected beliefs. There is first a belief that the world is independently real. Real apart from the scientist altogether. Real apart from our understanding of it. Now, to many of us this may be quite natural and simple, but remember, in the whole development from Locke through Hume and Kant down to Marx and the conventionalists and positivists, they've lost that concept. Now, Einstein held you cannot have any kind of rational knowledge or any kind of rational science unless you operate with a belief that the universe, is a world of reality, a real world, independent of your knowing of it. But further, there is a belief in the intrinsic intelligibility in that world. And this intrinsic intelligibility, this is part of Einstein's whole outlook, is so profound that it reaches indefinitely beyond what we are able to apprehend. And at times he can use Christian language in which he speaks about an infinite intelligence incarnate in existence. And then he can speak in another way of this intelligibility inherent in the universe, reaching out so far beyond us that with all our science we can only grasp it at its comparatively elementary levels. The universe is finite because it's the finite speed of light. It defines it as finite, but it is unbounded. We are unable to grasp more of it than relatively elementary levels. Now these are ultimate beliefs in Einstein's science. And so we find it here, science now beginning to operate once again with certain ultimate beliefs which are unverifiable and unfalsifiable. Now that's important. Take for example the concept which Einstein is very concerned with, I'll speak about in a moment, that there is order in the universe. Now you can't prove that. You can't falsify it. You can't verify it. In any proof that you attempt, you have to assume it in order to prove it. In the same way, you can't prove the laws of logic, you have to assume them in order to prove them. In the same way, you can't prove the principles of mathematics, you have to assume them in order to prove them. So that whether you're engaged in, even in logic or mathematics, there is a point where even Kant said you have to rely upon your mother wit. Mm-hmm. But Einstein sees quite clearly what controls us here are certain ultimate beliefs, and that belief of this kind is the mainspring of all scientific enterprise. And it's in this connection that we find Einstein's frequent and characteristic references to God. The most widely known, God does not play dice. Now that does not mean, as most people have taken it to be, that the world is determinist, and that he doesn't like quantum theory because it is indeterminate. On the contrary, by saying God does not play dice, what Einstein is saying is that order is real. It's a realist understanding of order in nature. We're concerned with, not with causality in the old form or determinism in the old form, because that is relativized by relativity. We are concerned with the fact that there is a profound integrated order in the configuration of the space-time metrical field which controls all things. And then again, God does not wear his heart on his sleeve. That is to say, you cannot understand nature by reading the truth of nature off its surface patterns. You cannot understand anything, in fact, by abstracting the surface patterns and tearing them away from their geometric frame or their ontological structure. You can only understand nature by seeing the patterns in their deep, profound root, and a root in intelligibility that reaches out infinitely beyond. God, he used to say, does not wear his heart on his sleeve. God, again, is not sophisticated. God is sophisticated, rather, but not malicious. Let's say God is very intricate. You can never understand the ultimate mysteries of nature. But nature doesn't play tricks with you. Nature doesn't deceive you. If you have come up against mistakes, you've got to blame yourself. You cannot put that blame on nature. Raffiniert ist der Herrgott, aber boshaft ist er nicht, he'd say. And there are certain ways of thinking, he said, realist ways of understanding natural law, which are closer to the secrets of the old one. Now here we have a very profound understanding of faith, and yet certainly problematic in Einstein. He could talk very movingly about that humble attitude of mind towards the grandeur of reason incarnate in existence, which in its profoundest depths is inaccessible to man, or of the rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all our systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. But let me read you another passage from him. The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical. Now that's rather interesting, because when Clerk Maxwell formulated his dynamical theory of the electromagnetic field, his old mentor, Lord Kelvin, who developed the whole concept of mechanical models and so on, wrote him a letter. And in this letter, it's unpublished, but Professor Gunn, the physicist in Glasgow University, gave me a copy of it. It's in Glasgow University Library, in which Lord Kelvin accuses Maxwell of tumbling into mysticism. Well, if relational thinking is mysticism, then Einstein is the greatest of all mystics. The most beautiful emotion that Einstein says we can experience is the mystical. It is the soul of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which all our faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms, this knowledge, this feeling, is the center of true religiousness. In this sense, and in this only, I belong to the ranks of devoutly religious men. The cosmic religious experience is the strongest and the noblest thing behind scientific research, which is derived from it. No one who does not appreciate the terrible exertion, the devotion without which pioneer work in scientific thought cannot come into being, can judge the strength of the feeling out of which alone such work, turned away as it is from immediate practical life, can grow. What deep faith in the rationality of the structure of the world, and what a longing to understand even a small glimpse of the reason revealed in the world there must have been in Kepler and Newton and so on. Well, I cite that to show that with Einstein we have brought back once again quite openly the fact that all his own scientific activity and all scientific activity is governed by an ultimate set of beliefs. They were simple, but they were profound. But Einstein has a problem. And to a certain extent, this is the influence of Descartes on him, and that is that he tended to stop short of thinking out the relation of this belief to what we call the personal. And so, in the last resort, Einstein tends to have, in this sense, a Spinozistic, impersonal concept of science and belief, although ambiguously Einstein himself can speak of the superpersonal in relation to God. The other day I was talking to John Archibald Wheeler about his a colleague that he used to have in Princeton, Eugene Wigner, one of the greatest physicists of our time, and for whom Wheeler has a great admiration. And he said, I asked Eugene the other day, who had influenced him the most in science. And he said, without any doubt, Michael Polanyi. Now, Wheeler's wife chipped in, well, they were both Hungarians. Well, to a certain extent, that is so. But Wigner had been the pupil of Polanyi. And I must say, I find that himself, myself, Polanyi is undoubtedly one of the greatest spirits of our age. I had the privilege of knowing him intimately, and before he died, he insisted that I should be literary executive of his works, so that after his death they wouldn't be bowdlerized in the way that some of Einstein's works have been bowdlerized. Now, what I'm after in Polanyi is this. One of the points that Polanyi was desperately concerned with is the place of the person in scientific activity. And the fact that the person must have a part in the model of scientific knowledge. And you know his great work on personal knowledge, which are Gifford lectures given in Aberdeen. But when we say personal, we have to be careful about what he means. In no sense is it personalist. It's the opposite of any kind of subjectivity or personalism. And may I say en passant that this is a point where Kierkegaard has been seriously misunderstood. When Kierkegaard says truth is subjectivity, he's not using the word, the translation is unfortunate. He's concerned with subject being, not subjectivity. He's concerned with truth in the form of personal being, it's being, but being in the form of subject and not simply as a mere object. Truth is a form of an object is impersonal by itself, but truth as we apprehend it in God and in Christ is truth in a subject being. And of course God is the supreme subject, and in that sense the one person and the personalizing being behind all knowledge. Now, it is basically in a similar sense in which Michael Polanyi speaks of the person in knowledge. There is no knowledge, even of a material realities, apart from the personal activity of the knower. So the personal factor must be brought within the structure of our scientific thought. Only a person is capable of distinguishing what he knows from his knowing of it. Only a person, therefore, is capable of critical understanding. Only a person is capable of objective operations. Only a person is capable of submitting his knowledge to the judgments of ultimate reality. And therefore, all through scientific knowledge, we have to take account of this factor. Now, the person, the rational agent, is concerned with the epistemic relation between the human mind and reality, which cannot be reduced to impersonal formalistic operations. Now, here I think of the fact that Einstein pointed out that what we are concerned with in scientific theory is what he called the extra-logical. Logic tells you nothing about being, or nothing about reality. Logic's only concerned with relations of ideas to ideas and statements to statements. And it is the bearing of all that upon what is not logical that is important. Or Maxwell. It's embodied mathematics, the bearing of mathematics upon what is non-mathematical, that is the precise point of real knowledge, or Polanyi. It's the bearing of our thought upon the objective pole. Now, only a person is capable of doing that. And that's what belief is about. Belief, conviction, has to do with the relation of our mind, not only to objective reality, but the relation of our mind to the intrinsic intelligibilities of objective reality. Faith has to do with the fact that we allow our minds to fall under the compelling claims of objective reality and its intrinsic intelligibility and think accordingly. And it is in that free obedience of the mind toward objective reality and objective truth that the personal factor plays its part. And so Polanyi could say that there is no human intelligence that can operate outside the context of faith and personal activity in that sense. So what he was concerned with, and he spent the last 20 years of his life, in many respects, trying to do this, to restore the balance of our cognitive powers between faith and reason. We believe, he used to quote from Augustine, but perhaps he should have quoted from Irenaeus and Clement and even Origen, because they all used these terms earlier, we believe in order that we may understand. If we do not believe, we cannot be established. Let's say the patristic concept of faith as that which places our feet on the actual substantial reality of God and of being. That's what faith is about. And that is what episteme is about. The scientific reason operates with faith, in which the reason stands upon the objective reality and the objective truth, and that relation you cannot convert into any kind of formal relation. To sum up, let me say that there are two things we must bear in mind. First, the need to recognize belief or intuitive apprehension once more as the basic source of knowledge. For it is through belief that we are in direct contact with reality, and through belief that our minds are kept open to the invisible realm of intelligibility independent of ourselves, and whatever may yet disclose its, whatever reality may yet disclose of itself to us in this way. Let us say rationality and faith are bound inextricably together. Now, of course, there is a difference between belief in natural science, the kind of belief we have in science, and the kind of belief we have in theology. But even in natural science, we have to operate with a personal factor in that kind of belief. And the second point I'd have you notice, how much greater is that personal factor or concerned with truth in the form of subject being and in theology? Here, then, the character of belief in knowledge of God is much more intense and much more profound and much more concerned with truth independent of ourselves. Now, this is very important. A scientist, and this is one of Wigner's problems, he told me that when he tries, the deeper he gets, the more he finds himself lapsing into solipsism. I'd say the more he's concerned to give theoretic explanation of the fundamental structures of nature, the more he's concerned with himself and having to escape from himself, and often his inability to escape from himself. So the scientist can, in very subtle ways, escape from the independence of objective truth. But you cannot manipulate the Lord God Almighty. The Lord God would object to you when you do that. When John Robinson was an undergraduate in Cambridge, I was talking to him one day. We were talking about pacifism, and he objected to the fact that God is judge. And I said to him, John, if you cannot believe that God is judge, if you cannot believe that God objects to you, then how can you distinguish God as objective reality in distinction from yourself? And that's the basic problem with him. He was unable to distinguish God from the ground of his own being. But he's trapped in a kind of solipsism. And if you add to that the point John Robinson made in one of his books, I Can Only Think, he says, in pictorial images, then poor John Robinson has a constitutional inability really to think of God. And we must be sympathetic with him. But you see, if you try to maneuver God, manipulate him, God objects. But the Lord God, the sheer lordliness of God and his truth, is the one reality you cannot manipulate. So that in theology, in the Bible, we are concerned with the truth that is independent of ourselves and even independent of the Bible, as Calvin says. So that in interpreting the scriptures, we have to allow the veritas retain its own dignitas and majestas over against us. And it's only as we do that we are really able to understand the Bible. Now, I'm always coming across students in different parts of the world who have a type of mind at which somehow they think that thinking is thinking statements or thinking ideas, but that's not thinking. Real rational thinking is thinking things through statements and through ideas. In science, we're concerned not with picturing models, but with disclosure models. That is to say, models, scientific models, are lenses we keep on revising that we may see reality through them and allow reality, independent of our models, to reveal itself to us. Is that not exactly what Calvin said about Holy Scripture? The Scriptures are the spectacles God gives us, so that we may apprehend the truth of God independent of ourselves, independent of the Bible. You see? Now, if we are unable to see that, then ultimately we are unable to grasp, I think, the depths of theology, and certainly unable to grasp modern science. Because science today teaches us that the truths that we are concerned with don't lie in these theoretical formulations. They lie in the realities to which they point us and direct us away from themselves. So that even when, quote Feynman here again, even when we develop, say, a scientific theory and give it mathematical expression, we may produce four or five or six or seven mathematical representations of which formally are all equally valid mathematically. But only one of them is true. And so you devise experiments in which you put your theory as a question to nature, and you have to allow nature alone, reality itself, to tell you which is true and which is false. And so ultimately, scientific theories are justified by reference to the grace of reality alone. Now that is the epistemological relevance of justification by faith. And unless in all our theological conceptions and our interpretation of the Bible itself, we are able to allow, St. Paul put it, and who put it more succinctly, let God be true and every man a liar. Whether he says you're Jews working within Revelation, Romans 2, or Gentiles, Romans 1, or Gentiles working outside, you have to, through justification, you let God be true and all your concepts on comparison are lies. That's exactly what Einstein says. Relativity relativizes, in the other sense of the word, all our conceptions about it, because it's upon the truth itself that we rely, independent of our concepts of it, and it's only a person in the commitment to the objective pole of reality and truth who can do that. So the personal and the objective are come together in this radical understanding of justification, epistemologically understood. And isn't it staggering that it takes modern science to teach us theologians how to understand the Bible in a more adequate way?